ETD News Time is 8:10. The morning show is next. Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of this week on the morning show revisiting some interesting morning shows from the past. And on today's program, interviews about two great and influential Americans, Dwight D. Eisenhower and Patrick Henry. Here's part one of today's program. We are spending this portion of the morning show examining one of the most important figures of the 20th century, and someone with whom we're still trying to really come to grips and fully understand. His name, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Of course, a former United States president, an exceedingly important general during the waging of the Second World War, and a figure who affected the course of history for our country and indeed for the world in ways that we even to this day maybe still do not fully appreciate and understand. A sprawling new biography of him has just been written by Gene Edward Smith, who is rightly acclaimed for his marvelous book about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he is a member of the faculty at the University of Toronto, was for 35 years, and at Marshall University for a dozen years, currently a senior scholar in the history department at Columbia University. And again, his new book is called Eisenhower in War and Peace. It's published by Random House. Gene Edward Smith, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
The very first sentence of the book in the preface says, Dwight Eisenhower remains an enigma. We probably could spend the next 25 minutes just having you explain that sentence. But in brief, what leads you to begin this important story in this way?
Well, it seems to me that Eisenhower is one of the most underrated presidents in American history. Everything that Eisenhower did, he made look easy. And that's why, in many respects, his accomplishments have sort of been diminished by interpreters of the period. Eisenhower made peace in Korea when no one thought that was possible. He twice refused to use nuclear weapons when the Joint Chiefs and his advisors on the National Security Council urged him to do so. He built the interstate highway system in the United States and the St. Lawrence Seaway. He added 10 million people to the Social Security rolls. These were people independent who worked independently, like doctors and lawyers and accountants. His accomplishments as president are just incredible. And he, as a military leader, he was the supreme commander of the largest coalition army ever assembled during World War II. So these are extraordinary. And because of Eisenhower's personal demeanor and style, he made all of these things look easy.
Hmm. And that's why your biography, of course, is so valuable to us, because it takes us, in a sense, beneath the surface in such effective fashion. A couple other things that are quite intriguing from this preface that I want to ask you about. As we look back at President Eisenhower, you say he may have been the last president to actually believe in the Constitution. What are you saying there?
Well, Eisenhower genuinely believed that it was up to Congress to determine, to pass laws and determine policy, and that his job as president was to execute that policy. I think that was really what I was getting at, that beginning with John Kennedy, I think, afterwards, and most of President Kennedy's successors have believed that the formation of policy was really their responsibility. Ike took a different view. He believed that that was Congress's job, although I must say that he did his best to influence Congress.
As you wrote this book, I must say, as I read it, I am profoundly impressed by the lack of bias. That is, we'll read one page and we are being told glowing accounts of Dwight D. Eisenhower's greatness, and then we'll turn the page and there will be a very frank account of some misstep or some personal demon or some other way in which he fell short of what we think of as complete greatness. I'm very impressed by your even-handedness.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if that, for someone in your line of work as a historian, comes naturally, or if that is something that requires, in a sense, supreme conscious effort to not allow any personal bias you might have about the man or about the president or about the general swaying things in terms of how you draw your portrait of this man.
Well, it doesn't come naturally, but it's something you really have to work on. And I guess having written five biographies, I have tried to develop that habit of looking at things objectively. And one of the biggest problems, I think, for a biographer, if there's something bad there, you have developed such a relationship with the person about whom you're writing that often you're inclined to diminish it or to conceal it. And really, that doesn't give an objective portrait of the person involved. And so it's important to bring out the warts as it is to dwell on the individual's accomplishments. And I've tried to do that. I must say, writing about Eisenhower is much different from writing about Franklin Roosevelt, because Eisenhower was very much of a private person, whereas FDR, most of it was on the surface. If I could just say one other thing, when I started writing about Eisenhower back 5 years ago, I told my wife we were going to have to go out to Abilene, Kansas, and stay there for about 7 or 8 months while I exhausted the resources in the Eisenhower Library. And she wasn't too fond of that. She said, "Gene, why don't you write a biography of de Gaulle?"
And head off to Paris.
Exactly.
We're speaking with...
That may be next.
We're speaking with Gene Edward Smith. We're talking about his brand new book, which is called Eisenhower in War and Peace. You give us some account of the childhood of Dwight D. Eisenhower, the rather limited economic resources of his family. I mean, actually, downright poverty at certain points in time. But really, the first incredible thing I read in this portion of the book was when you said that if it hadn't been for athletics, it's very questionable whether young Dwight D. Eisenhower would have completed his 4 years at West Point. It's really amazing to think about how his life, and for that matter, sort of the chart of world history, might have been radically altered if events had not gone as they had at West Point.
Well, Eisenhower looked at West Point a little bit like Grant and Pershing did. They went there for an education, very much unlike the attitude of Douglas MacArthur and George Patton, who went in search of military glory. For Eisenhower, he and Grant, they could take the Army or leave it at that point in their lives, and it was the athletics and the camaraderie that kept Ike at West Point, and he did very well. One of the curious things, Ike received a serious knee injury as he was playing football and couldn't play for the last 2 years that he was at West Point, but he became head cheerleader at West Point. Curiously, Franklin Roosevelt was head cheerleader at Harvard. Ronald Reagan was head cheerleader at Eureka College, and George W. Bush was head cheerleader at Andover. It's curious.
It sure is. In the chapter of your book called The Great War, in which we find out about Eisenhower's experiences during what we now call the First World War, one of the most interesting and insightful statements you make is the fact that Dwight D. Eisenhower missed seeing, in a sense, actual combat in the First World War. Didn't miss it by much, but essentially the war ended before he was actually out on the battlefield. You say that this, in fact, might have been of profound importance in terms of what kind of a general he was and how he led during the Second World War.
I think that's true. It's a little introverted argument, but the people who served in the trenches in World War I really understood it firsthand, the severity of the sacrifice and what was involved, and particularly among the British officers who saw much more of it, that made them very reluctant to perhaps to risk men's lives unnecessarily. Not having seen that, I think Eisenhower looked at it somewhat more abstractly and was therefore able to commit troops to battle with less reluctance, perhaps, than if he had been in the trenches night after night after night in the First World War.
And haunted by those kind of images. You write, unlike many British senior commanders, Eisenhower had not been shocked into excessive caution by the futile slaughter of World War I. He was ready for a war of maneuver, and his early experience with America's nascent tank corps perhaps prepared him far better than a year in the trenches would have done.
I think that's correct. Eisenhower spent, as you mentioned, World War I at Gettysburg at the Army's Tank Training Center. He was the commander of that. He was graduated from West Point in 1915, and he was one of three members of his class who rose as high as the rank of lieutenant colonel. Only three of them did. And then after the war, he was reduced to the rank of major and stayed in that rank for 16 years. Promotions in the Army in those days were strictly by seniority, and Eisenhower's turn didn't come up until 16 years later. So he was for 16 years a major in the Army.
During the chapter called The Peacetime Army, where we chart his life between the world wars, this is where we learn some of the most interesting things about the marriage between Dwight D. Eisenhower and his wife, Mamie Dowd. And one facet of their marriage I don't remember hearing much about was the very sad death of their first son, which you say was an event that seems to have dramatically and perhaps permanently altered the chemistry between husband and wife.
I think so. I think each one secretly, in some respects, blamed the other. It was the child was named Ike. He was a little over three years old. He died of scarlet fever when Ike was stationed at Fort Meade in Maryland. And I think the marriage was never the same. Was never the same after that. They both took it very hard, particularly Eisenhower. And there was just nothing they could do. The medical profession was such at the time that there was just nothing that they could do to save the child. And that it was a traumatic moment for both of them.
Right. We should maybe mention that in charting their relationship, their marriage, and some of its difficulties, that you, in a sense, have only half of what you would want to have. That is, you have the letters that the one sent to the other, but not the other letters. And this is sort of an intriguing situation in and of itself.
That's correct. In the 1980s, when Kay Summersby published her second book called Past Forgetting, My Love Affair with Dwight D. Eisenhower, John Eisenhower, the president's son, then shortly after that, published a book called Letters to Mamie, which were Ike's letters to his wife during World War II. Strangely, Mamie's letters to Ike not only have never been published, but it's not exactly clear where they are. John says that they don't exist, and it's difficult to believe. But anyway, we certainly don't know of their existence at this point. But clearly, many of Ike's letters were written in reply to Mamie's letters to him, and for some reason, I have a feeling that it was that John may have felt it was best to dispose of those.
As we chart those later years between the wars, among other things, you tell us that Dwight D. Eisenhower, in the wake of the stock market crash and the Great Depression, became caught up in the excitement of the New Deal. And it helps us understand that Eisenhower, at least in some respects, was a very complicated mix of philosophies. I mean, conservative in some ways, quite progressive in others.
That's right. But I think most importantly, Eisenhower was extremely intelligent and had the ability to grow as he was exposed to new situations. I think he began from a very, very conservative standpoint, as the professional army during the interwar years were. And during his time in Washington, I think changed considerably. And as he was exposed to new situations, as during World War II, as he was exposed to the British and the French, he changed a great deal. And he was able to mature. He was never wedded to ideas of a previous age.
Hmm. You write, as he saw more of the world, as he dealt with policy issues, he learned to appreciate a diversity of viewpoints and to value the intrinsic individuality of Western society. What set him apart from some of his regular Army contemporaries was Eisenhower's ability to absorb the lessons around him and broaden his outlook.
Oh, that's absolutely correct, and I would stand by that paragraph forever.
We're speaking with Gene Edward Smith about his book, Eisenhower in War and Peace. And we should add that, I mean, it's hard to know where to begin or where to end in a biography that spans more than 900 pages. But of course, I mean,
that includes Index.
Right, of course. But I mean, it's a fascinating book, and some of the most interesting chapters deal with those chapters of his life and career that many of us know very little about, like, for instance, the time he spent in the Philippines with Douglas MacArthur in the 1930s. But with time already receding here rapidly, I think we should move to the Second World War. And one of the things you say about Eisenhower as you chart his significance is sort of differentiating between, in a sense, different kinds of military leadership. And the fact that Eisenhower was in many respects ideally suited to be the supreme commander, but on the other hand, on sort of a level down from that, when it came to the nuts and bolts strategies of the battlefield, that would be a kind of leadership in which he was much more limited.
That's absolutely correct. The French have expressed it marvelously. They say that Eisenhower was the right man in the right place at the right time, and that would be for the supreme commander, for handling a coalition army that included the French and the British and the Canadians as well as the Americans. And all of Eisenhower's principal deputies were British throughout the war. But Eisenhower was uniquely able to bring all of those people together to keep them fighting in the same direction, really, and to set the overall strategy and then leave it to them to carry out that strategy on the battlefield. Men like Patton and Montgomery, who were far better off, far better battlefield commanders than Ike, but who would have been impossible. It would have been impossible for them to do the job that Ike did.
Among the insights you share is that when it came to a very important decision, that is, for the Allies to invade North Africa in 1942 rather than attempting a cross-channel attack on the European continent, you call this the most far-reaching American strategic decision of the war. And this was one that Roosevelt was responsible for. I had never heard this spelled out so clearly. Briefly explain why this was such a crucial decision in the Second World War.
Well, the War Department and the Army General Staff assumed that they could invade Germany or invade France across the channel in late 1942, which was just absurd. The American Army wasn't nearly ready for that, and the Germans were far stronger in 1942 than they were in 1944. It was just a pipe dream. And FDR was insistent that the United States come to grips with the Germans during 1942. Don't forget, the Germans didn't attack Pearl Harbor. The Japanese did. And Roosevelt, nevertheless, made Germany the principal enemy for the United States. And in order to be able to carry that through, he needed the Army to come to grips with the Germans someplace in 1942. And when it turned out that it was impossible to cross the channel, then North Africa simply emerged by default, and the invasion followed. And the North African campaign was really a learning experience, both for the American Army and for Eisenhower. They clearly showed that they were would have been totally unprepared to invade Europe at that time. But I think what I was suggesting by the crucial decision, it goes back to Pearl Harbor and the fact that it was the Japanese who attacked the United States. Roosevelt reversed American policy and made Germany the number one enemy, and we came to grips with it with the invasion of North Africa.
During those years of the Second World War, of course, there are all kinds of relationships that are worth exploring, and you do it quite thoroughly. His relationship, for instance, with American generals like Patton or Omar Bradley or General Marshall, his relationship with British General Montgomery or Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And, of course, you do not shy away from what is, of course, a matter of incredible complexity and delicacy, and that is this woman, Kay Summersbee, with whom Eisenhower had a very close relationship, and some ventured to believe an out-and-out affair. I wonder if you could, without us trying to summarize something so complicated in just a few moments, I wonder if you could just say a word about the challenge of writing about this enigma.
Well, the challenge begins with trying to determine what the facts were. And this is a trail that's been muddied by various people for a long time to conceal various things, and it really required a great deal of effort to try to piece things together. And as best I could do, it seemed to me that this was a very loving relationship. This was a wartime romance that existed for 3 years, and it ended abruptly when the war was over, but I don't think one should diminish the passion of this relationship. Kay was not really his driver. Kay drove him initially for 2 weeks when he was in London, but his driver throughout the war and afterwards was Sergeant Leonard Dry in the United States Army. And Sergeant Dry was always offended when Kay was called Ike's driver. Kay was Eisenhower's associate, and it was a very close relationship. It wasn't that unusual. Patton had a relationship. Beetle Smith had a relationship. Everett Hughes at Eisenhower's headquarters had a relationship. The leading generals at MacArthur's headquarters had relationships. This was not at all unusual. This was war. These men were overseas. But by and large, the relationships didn't continue after that. And it was not all that unusual, I think.
Mm. Ultimately, of course, Eisenhower returns with great acclaim. For some years is the head of Columbia University, an experience which begins promisingly and does not end all that well. And, of course, ultimately, Dwight D. Eisenhower becomes president of the United States. And what is so intriguing is, although many people thought of him as kind of an average Joe and first of all General Eisenhower, who then became president, you tell us time and again that, in fact, politics came very naturally to Eisenhower, and in many respects, he was a master.
He was a master at politics, particularly because he always concealed his hand. Professor Fred Greenstein at Princeton has a nice little book, The Hidden Hand Presidency, about Eisenhower. He was always careful not to show his hand and to be behind the scenes. During the Army-McCarthy hearings, for example, Eisenhower was calling the plays for the Army throughout that. But he didn't want to come to grips directly with McCarthy. I think he told his brother, "I don't want to get into a pissing contest with a skunk." But Eisenhower was clearly calling the plays from behind, and he orchestrated the Army's response and ultimately the Senate's vote of censure for the Wisconsin senator.
Hmm.
Yes.
You call Eisenhower a true professional in this sense. Like a true professional, Eisenhower made things look easy. He was a master of the essentials. He knew instinctively which matters required his attention and which could be delegated to subordinates. I mean, this is part of why we tend to underestimate how good a president he was. Could you just say a word about an unsealed envelope which ended up on his desk early in his first term?
I was thinking about that as you were speaking. Just after the inaugural parade, Eisenhower went into the White House for the first time as president. The chief usher gave him a sealed envelope, and Eisenhower addressed to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower handed it back to him and said, "Never give me a sealed envelope again. That someone on the staff should be reading these things and only giving me what is important for me to see." It was a teaching opportunity for Eisenhower and the White House staff at that point.
Very much so. And, of course, you go on to explore his health setbacks, the important work which he did on our interstate highway system, the way in which he confronted the situation with the Suez Canal in 1956. As you explore all of these facets and more of the Eisenhower presidency, one thing really leapt out at me at the start of one chapter when you mentioned that Eisenhower, like the Roosevelt, the Eisenhowers, like the Roosevelts, were accustomed to servants. When Eisenhower got out of bed each morning, Sergeant Money held the president's undershorts for him to step into. And you go on to list some other things as well. I only mention that because as I read that, I was, astonished on a couple of different levels, I suppose, but mostly that was so at odds with the way that everybody viewed Dwight D. Eisenhower, Ike, the guy we like. We never would have thought of him as someone accustomed to that kind of life of privilege.
I'm not sure it was a life of privilege, but it was a life of personal support. He had been in the Army, and really from 1941 on, as a senior general that he became, he was accustomed to a large personal staff who drove him, who dressed him, who took care of all of his creature comfort needs. When Eisenhower left the White House, he not only had to learn to drive, he had to learn to dial a telephone. We were back in the dial telephone days then, and Ike didn't know how to dial a telephone. He had all that personal support, but again, that freed him. It wasn't luxury. It simply freed him from the details of the daily life that allowed him to concentrate on larger issues.
I'm glad you clarified that, because I actually came away from that paragraph kind of thinking it in more the way that I had framed it. So you have helped me understand that point much more correctly. And for any of our listeners who will end up seeking out your book, ultimately, as you came to the end of this odyssey of writing such a thoroughly researched biography of this intriguing man, do you feel like you came away profoundly surprised by anything about Dwight D. Eisenhower?
I wouldn't say surprised, but I think it's terribly impressed by his accomplishments, which were far greater than I had anticipated when I began to write. His intervention in Little Rock during the desegregation crisis in Little Rock, when he sent the 101st Airborne Division in, if Ike hadn't done that, if he hadn't responded with overwhelming force to enforce the district court's order, desegregation in the United States would have been set back one or two generations. He was telegraphing to the South that this was the law of the land, and the federal government was going to enforce it.
Well, that and many other fascinating moments and chapters in this long life and important career, military and political, of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, by so many different benchmarks, remains one of the most extraordinarily successful presidents in our nation's history. The book, Eisenhower in War and Peace, published by Random House. Gene Edward Smith, my thanks to you for writing this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Many WGTD listeners, I hope, will remember a conversation I recorded with Harlow Giles Unger about a book called The Last Founding Father, in which he examined the life and legacy and career of our fifth president, James Monroe. His latest book is called Lion of Liberty, Patrick Henry, and the Call to a New Nation. It is a very insightful look at this important, charismatic American and the difference that he made in America's efforts to throw off the shackles of British rule. And also some of the ways in which he was ultimately also a divisive figure in our new country, and particularly in that volatile period between our victory in the Revolutionary War and George Washington's inauguration as our first president in 1789. That is a period of time we don't often pay much attention to. So I'm so grateful to Harlow Giles Unger for creating such a fascinating book, which offers us rich insights into this really crucial moment in our nation's history. And he joins us for the next few minutes to talk about his book, which is published by Dacapo Press. Harlow Giles Unger, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
One of the intriguing things about Patrick Henry is that he seems to be a figure who is among the greatest orators of his generation, maybe the greatest among all those founding fathers, and yet also someone who on the surface had a lot of sort of had a very rough-hewn kind of exterior, which said a lot about where he came from. Can you just speak a moment about this intriguing mix?
Yes, indeed. I believe that Patrick Henry was the second most important founding father after Washington. His great speech, "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death," is known by most school children in America, but few Americans know what Henry really meant, and even fewer know anything about Henry the man himself. By "Give Me Liberty and Give Me Death," Patrick Henry was railing against all big government. He was not just intending to throw off the yoke of the British government. He had no intention of allowing a new American government to form with the powers, the same powers as the British government, which Americans fought for 7 years to overthrow. And that's exactly what they did, of course, at the Constitutional Convention. Henry refused to attend the Constitutional Convention because of his opposition to big government, which he considered totally unjust. He believed in justice, and he believed that a big government, a central government far from the people, was necessarily unjust because of the distance they maintained from the people. He believed that only local people, the people in the community who owned property and knew the affairs of that community, should govern that community.
So he was very distrustful of too much power being given to a central government, and that opposition became especially fierce at a moment when it appeared that such a government was an absolute necessity for this new nation to survive.
Absolutely. He was not opposed to a loose confederation, which is exactly what we had after the Revolutionary War. The Confederation of American States. He believed there should be some central authority with power to unite the states in common defense against foreign enemies and to regulate international trade and interstate trade. But he believed in local rule, in states' rights, and he fought for that all his life. He was a farmer. He was not a very wealthy man at first. He was a farmer, and like most farmers, he believed that the fruits of the earth were a gift from God as a reward for his toil and labor, and he was not about to share it with some distant government. He had nothing to do with government. Government gave nothing to him, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it. So he opposed taxation without representation, not just by Britain, but by the federal government. And he warned that the Constitution, the necessary and proper clause, as it's called in the Constitution, would give Congress the right to pass any laws it wanted to and enact any taxes it wanted to without the consent of the people. He wanted an amendment to force Congress to get approval of two-thirds of the state legislatures before enacting any federal tax. Of course, he didn't get that.
It's interesting to think about how different history might have unfolded had such a measure been approved.
Absolutely.
You mentioned that he was a farmer, but he was also a lawyer. And one of the little details in your book that I so appreciated is You tell us a little bit about his path towards becoming a lawyer and how, for that time and place, it was a very different path from the one that it is now. Can you just say a word about that?
Yes, indeed. Well, there were no schools in the Hill Country, the Piedmont hills of central Virginia, where Henry grew up. So his parents educated him. His father was a well-educated, cultured Scotsman, a farmer also, and a justice of the peace. But he taught Henry basic grammar and English and mathematics, and went on to teach him history and science and Latin and Greek. Homeschooling was the rule in that part of the world at that time. And Henry then studied law on his own and became not only mastered law, he was a great, great student, and he was probably a genius. Certainly he was brilliant. But he not only mastered the law, he combined all the his mastery of the law and legal tactics with a fantastic sense of humor, which usually made opposition lawyers look like fools. And, of course, the jurors, being farmers just like Henry, always embraced him. And he became the most successful, most brilliant courtroom lawyer in America at the time.
Hmm. One thing you tell us about Patrick Henry, the man, that is quite intriguing is his sort of conflicted beliefs about slavery. Or actually, that's kind of a wrong way to put it, because he had actually very strong beliefs about slavery itself. There really wasn't much conflict in that respect. But that was a bit at odds with what ended up happening with him and his life, and the fact that he ultimately did come into the ownership of slaves.
Yes, he never bought or sold any slaves himself. Many of the properties he bought came with slaves. They were property and part of the land. When you bought land, he despised slavery, as did George Washington. Most Virginia planters opposed slavery, and indeed, in the early part of the 18th century, Virginia planters had voted to ban slavery at a time when there were very few slaves in this country. But the English government overruled them, because the Royal Treasury needed the money and profits from the international slave trade. So that's why slavery came into Virginia. Virginia planters didn't invent slavery. It was not an American institution. They inherited it. And Patrick Henry was outraged by it. But by that time, because of British importation of slaves throughout the century, the slave population had reached 200,000. And it was now an impossible situation. These were largely illiterate, unskilled people. There was no way to free them. Where would they go in the South? The only work was for field hands. There were no cities or towns with opportunities for apprentice craftsmen. So this was an intractable problem now that wouldn't be solved until the Civil War, of course.
Mm-hmm. And you write at one point, the conflict of his moral opposition to slavery and his ownership of slaves tore at Patrick Henry's heart and mind throughout his life. You mentioned the state of Virginia. That's something else that is a very important element in Patrick Henry's story, is the fact that he is a man of Virginia, and that Virginia plays such a crucial role in many of these events, and particularly when America sort of comes to the decision to fight, it so much hinges on whether or not Virginia is pledged to be part of that fight. Just say a word about why Virginia was so important, and Patrick Henry's role as a Virginian in some of these crucial events.
Well, most Americans don't realize that Virginia, at the time of the Revolution, was America's largest, most powerful, richest, and most heavily populated state. It was huge. It stretched from Chesapeake Bay to the Mississippi River and up to the Great Lakes. It was a gigantic state. So the rest of the colonies could never have fought a revolution against Britain without the support of Virginia. And Patrick Henry was Virginia's first governor. Therefore, he was the most important civilian leader in the colonies and in the new United States. His support of George Washington and the Continental Army was critical to victory. He ensured Virginia's giving more aid, more military support to the Continental Army than any other state. And then he himself sent troops into the West. It was he that was in charge of the Western campaign that seized the Illinois Territory along with Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky from the British. That was all his doing. That had nothing to do with the Continental Army and Washington. So he played a critical role in the Revolutionary War. And then later, of course, when the Constitution was sent to the states for ratification, he led the opposition in Virginia, although he lost the fight. But without Virginia, even if the other 12 states had ratified the Constitution, there would have been no effective nation economically or politically. Virginia was just too important to the Americas at that time.
One of the most challenging things for us as modern Americans is to sort of place ourselves back in that day to understand how, for instance, the words of a Patrick Henry would be known to other colonists. I mean, and even for that matter, known to his fellow citizens of Virginia. And you talk about several moments in which Patrick Henry is almost ingenious in the way that he makes certain that his battle cry is heard by the people who need to hear it and be inspired by it.
Yes, one thing we have to remember is that the only people who could vote in those days were white males who owned property. So that meant the electorate was relatively small. 300-400 votes in a city was enough to put a man in office. There were 24 newspapers across the country. Most people were illiterate. The newspapers were circulated to the most educated and wealthiest Americans. It was a tight-knit community that ran this country. It was an oligarchy that ran in every state. And eventually in the Congress. Most Americans had nothing to say about the running of this country. So it was relatively easy for a Washington, a Patrick Henry, a John Adams to come to power in their respective states and eventually in the national government.
One of the intriguing parallels between what was important to Patrick Henry and some of the conversation which is occurring now is with the modern Tea Party movement. I wonder if you could just say a word about the similarities and the contrasts which there might be between Patrick Henry, who he was, what was important to him, and what seems to be embodied by the so-called Tea Party movement of the present day.
Like Patrick Henry, whom I call the Lion of Liberty in my new book, many Tea Party advocates resent the intrusion of the federal government and state government, of course, in our daily lives. The government is in every aspect of our lives, in our homes, in our workplaces, our rivers and streams and the water we drink, the air we breathe, everything we do, everything is regulated by government nowadays. And even Washington would be turning over in his grave if he saw that. But Patrick Henry especially would be opposed to all government intrusion in people's personal lives. And many of the Tea Party supporters feel the same way. However, this is a different age and a different time, and it's interesting to see many of the Tea Party people who say they don't want government pork legislation, except in their own states. They don't want government bailouts to industries, except their particular industry. we don't see any people in Alaska or Colorado or Utah against bailouts for the mining industry, but they don't want any other. They don't want the financial industry in New York bailed out. So these Tea Party people are a little bit hypocritical, talking about liberty and using Patrick Henry's words. You automatically deprive someone else of their liberty the minute you walk down the street. When you walk down a line, along a line on a street, it automatically deprives other people of walking along that line. This is a different urbanized society, crowded with people in America today. At the time of Patrick Henry, he lived an independent, self-sufficient life on a huge farm. He didn't need government. Government didn't need him. And he didn't want any intrusion in his life. He gladly got together with his neighbors to fight a common enemy. But that was it.
A quick word about the significance that Patrick Henry played in the enactment of the so-called Bill of Rights. Why was this important to him, and what role did he play?
Well, his main objection to the Constitution was that there was no guarantees of individual liberties. There was no guarantee of the right of free speech, the right of freedom of the press, religious freedom. As he said, when he examined the features of the Constitution, they appeared to him frightful. Where are your checks in this government? He said there are no checks, no real balances. They are based on a supposition that your American governors shall be honest. He said, show me that age and country where the rights and liberties of the people were based on the chance of their rulers being honest men, and I'll show you a country that lost its liberties. He wanted specific guarantees of individual freedom to fight to prevent tyranny, and he wanted specific limits on the powers of the federal government. He got some of the guarantees of individual liberties in the Bill of Rights that was the 10 amendments that were added to the Constitution in the first Congress. And he got a SOP of limitation of federal government powers in the 10th Amendment. But basically, there were no limits ever imposed on the federal government to the extent that he wanted them. And the net result is that we've had presidents that have taken us into undeclared wars in all but five wars in history. All the wars we've ever been in, except for five, have been undeclared wars, which the president made the decision unilaterally. Similarly, we've had taxes after taxes imposed by the Congress and laws passed without really the consent of the people. We've had taxation without representation, much the same way that we had under England.
You sound like quite a fan of Patrick Henry and sympathetic to his attitude.
Well, I used the title Lion of Liberty for my book on him because that's what he was. He really believed in liberty and justice for all.
And, of course, it's important to be reminded that on some of these important questions, he was at odds with the great George Washington, who saw anarchy where Patrick Henry saw liberty.
Exactly. And this is a big debate even today. We have great difficulty, not only Americans, people all over the world, have great difficulty drawing the line between liberty and license. Where is that line? I don't think many people know how to draw it, especially when their own interests are at stake.
The book outlines all kinds of fascinating details about Patrick Henry's life and career, including the tragedy that befell his first wife due to mental illness, a great deal of information as we know it on some of his most famous speeches, and even Patrick Henry's connection to our own Civil War. all explored in this fascinating book called Lion of Liberty, Patrick Henry and the Call to a New Nation. It's a publication of Da Capo Press. Harlow Giles Unger, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you for inviting me.